Welcome to Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart. Here we are again, Paul, on this first Friday in October, and boy, fall is definitely in the air. It's chilly.
Yep, I quit wearing shorts. Today I'm wearing a jacket. I feared there would be frost on the windshield, but there wasn't. It was about 40 degrees, but it's definitely fall. And Football Friday will be maybe my winter coat. Is that possible?
Paul, we're happy you're not wearing shorts for a variety of reasons, but I'm fearing there would be frost on your legs if you had been wearing shorts.
Yeah, it would really be slick. It would, my furnace, you know, I tried to kick that on. Thermostat doesn't work. Need to have a repair, man. So nice start to the heating
there
season.
There you go. There you go. Well, at least you still had warm water today for a shower.
That's true, yes.
We have quite a broadcast today, Paul. The Public Relations Manager for the City of Ames, Susan Guiazda. She's going to drop by with word on what's coming up around these parts, and she's bringing along a guest, the fire chief, Rich Higgins.
And after that, old friend Maggie Westfall will join us with another of her unforgettable looks at life here in Iowa.
But our first guest on this Friday is the man in charge of planning and housing for the City of Ames. We are pleased to welcome Kelly Diekman to Local Talk. Welcome, Kelly. You have been here in the area in Ames for about 6 years. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, I grew up in the Midwest in South Dakota, and I graduated from South Dakota State University. But I left the Midwest and went to the West Coast to start my career. So I spent a few years in Oregon and then about 11 years in California before coming here.
What brought you here?
Wanted to get a more family-oriented lifestyle. I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area, pretty active place.
Yep.
Had some kids and said, we need some more space.
Know the feeling. My wife and I were in San Francisco with kids. We moved out for the same reason. It's a little tough to live up there in that environment raising kids.
Yeah, it's a great place, but
it is.
It's just a different lifestyle when you have a big family.
We have a lot of things to ask you about today, but first off, let's talk about the planning department. It has a lot of different roles and responsibilities. Give us a brief overview.
Yeah, so we're the planning and housing department. We're a staff of six. And for housing, we really administer federal funding through the Community Development Block Grant, and that's oriented towards helping low and moderate income areas or even directly helping some households in some situations. But the planning side, this is where we do a lot of things. It's all city business. It's about doing individual project reviews, subdivisions, but it's also long-term policy projects. City Council wants to think about long-range planning, whether that's 5, 10, 20 years out. Those are tasks we get to. So we do a lot of things kind of helping get the both the housing and the commercial expectations moving forward for the city.
And this talks about Ames Plan 2040.
Yeah.
Talk about that, Kelly. What kind of things are involved in that? It sounds impressive and far-reaching.
It is supposed to be that. So in planning, we always have a kind of our constitution. It's called a comprehensive plan. So most states, including Iowa, require a city to have some general expectations to be able to administer rules for really specific situations. And that's called a comprehensive plan. Our last one was done in 97. We've eclipsed its growth goals, or not even its goals, its expectations and projections. Doesn't really match kind of how we're looking at ourselves now. So the council wanted to start over, get a new plan. Let's go out to 2040. 20 years is probably about the most reasonable time period you could have some expectations for. There's no way we can predict 2040, but we can at least plan for what that might be.
And they're projecting an increase of 15,000.
Yeah, so one of the first steps in the process, we have a consultant team, RDG, housed in Omaha and Des Moines, and they have other offices too as our consultant lead on this. One of the first things we need to do is kind of figure out what are we comfortable with thinking, how many people might be in the city after or going forward, and we decided that about a 1.5% growth rate, which is similar to the last 15 years, pretty healthy growth rate, but not crazy fast, and that gets us about 15,000 people. So that's how we've kind of messaged this, is it's about the next 15,000 people. Where can they be in Ames? What do we need to do to support 15,000 people?
Now, RDG has put together a couple of presentations at the City Council, and I have seen them. Talk about what they've done in terms of potential growth areas. They've set aside, projected some possibilities for the city. Please go into detail on that.
Yeah, I will a little bit. There's a lot of tasks putting this plan together, and it's a little bit of a learning exercise for us because the 97 plan was really only focused on the issue of land use and where the city would grow. And we're trying to expand the thought process a little bit with the comprehensive plan and bring other issues besides land use into it and just where are we going to annex land to kind of think about, well, how do the environmental concerns filter through all of this? How does transportation work together with how you want to grow a place? How do you want to serve it? So we're trying to be a little more comprehensive. However, it still comes back to land use. Mm-hmm. And that's been our first issue, is we know as a city that we don't have places that are just easy to grow for the next 15,000 people. So the first task was to look at four different areas about how could we grow on the perimeter of the city. We have a separate task to look at infill options, too. And we haven't reported out on that. So a lot of people are very interested in what can we do to bring density into the city and have infill and be very efficient with growth as well as external growth. But in July, we had a big workshop with council where we were, again, taking 15,000 people and modeling how that could fit in four different locations in the city. That was in total 60,000 people. That's not really what we're trying to do, but we wanted to understand what hurdles there were for growth. And we have hurdles. There's, like I said, there's no easy way to do this. So the city is in the process of refining that information. We expect to go to council again later this fall with a lot more information about like true costs and kind of service levels before you have to expand resources a lot to serve that. So we looked north. We looked east of I-35, which is something that we had no records of the city really ever contemplating. We also looked south along Highway 69. Again, not a lot of history on the city looking at growing further south than we already are. And then we looked west as well, and we have in the past looked west. So it's kind of four completely different areas. You get four completely different results about what you might think is important for the city in terms of how it looks as connecting back to the city, or how does it augment where people are interested in being, and what are the options there for providing more housing and more commercial opportunities for people.
And of course, an issue is, and going back to your experiences, both of you in San Francisco, I read now that for regular average people, affordable housing is not available to any degree in San Francisco.
Right.
You know, there's a real problem on people with regular middle-class salaries affording housing in some of these highly developed areas and highly favored areas to live in. And is that a consideration, affordable housing?
It is, but in a 20-year comprehensive plan document, we're not getting directly to which projects are viable economically. But we are definitely, as a comprehensive plan, we don't just want to say this is an area where we can grow and that's the decision. We want to make sure we're getting what we're really looking at as a diverse housing mix. So what policies can we put in place that when the developer comes in, when it's time for that area to develop, that we're meeting a housing need? I mean, there's a lot of different ways to look at housing in Ames. And I'll say everywhere I go, we can use any kind of housing somebody wants to build. So there's not just one thing that we need. We're going to have some newer issues coming up as the baby boomers are aging. They're just now getting to that demographic's now just moving into the 70s where they're going to start looking at totally different housing options. So that's a new influence that we have some of. We've seen a few different retirement-based developments in the last few years, but that's something that's going to be coming forward. And that changes how single-family homes get built. That changes whether people stay in their homes and move out of their neighborhoods.
Each of these areas that the city is looking at, or that RDG has looked at, have their own individual problems if they are going to be chosen, infrastructure issues. Can you talk about those in each area?
Yeah, so they have a lot of commonality, but the solutions are not obviously going to work for every area because they're so diverse geographically. So one of the things that we know as a city is that we've used up a lot of our sanitary sewer capacity in the pipes. The plant, perfectly fine, has capacity. We can hook more people up to it and be fine at that level. Water plant's brand new. But we do know that the system that's been in the ground for 100 years has limits. And we got to be very cognizant of that because that causes obviously major problems for people if we don't anticipate that in front. So all of our areas, three of the four anyways, west, east, and north, sanitary sewer is something that we have to solve for. That means we have to look at new large trunk lines just to serve somewhere. We just can't hook on to what's already there. To the south, it's a little easier. That's where the main trunk line is that goes to the plant. But then transportation becomes the other one that's more obvious to everybody. There's obviously, when you're in North Ames, it takes a while to filter through the street network to get to either to campus or to get further south or to I-35. And a lot of the conversation is, you know, Ames isn't just a job base at the campus anymore. It's got a large industrial and employment opportunities on the south and east side of town. But we see a lot of split employment households, a lot of people going south to work, a lot of people coming into the city as well. So does that commute pattern suggest that our transportation needs might be different long term, whereas in the past we've kind of looked at how do we keep people in and focused on these neighborhoods around campus or even in more a little bit more broader ring nowadays. So we know that there's going to be issues on local streets. We're going to know that arterial streets would have a lot more traffic. We also have seen that the interchanges will likely – in long term, need another interchange. A lot of those capacity issues will have to get looked at. People that probably don't know this, but DOT is in the process of planning and probably going to be executing making I-35 a 6-lane road in the next 15 years, maybe 10 years. So that's just another idea that's out there that we get all the way to Ames. Again, facilitating north-south access into Ames. So we probably have a little bit bigger expectation of regionalism, at least in our mind right now as staff, trying to think through where do we fit in the region, not just Ames, not just Story County, but how do we work with the Des Moines metro area as well.
Very complex issues there. What sort of things are highly controversial, Kelly? Where you anticipate problems, conflicts, disagreements about policy?
Yeah, I think pretty common, and just based on my experience in Ames, these issues will always come up. Are we ensuring that we are getting the housing diversity that meets multiple people's needs and not just one type? The big one is always, what's the cost? Is there an expectation of city assistance for any of this stuff to happen? There's always city assistance at some level, right? The ratepayer pays for the sewer plants to exist and to do maintenance and all of those kinds of things. But sometimes we also have to facilitate closing of a gap. And that's always been a challenge in Ames of what are we trying to accomplish efficiently and effectively with the lowest cost option that we can do. And that might be a tricky thing to do because we now know we have big gaps to close. And if we can't close them or how do we partner with a developer to do that, it might be tricky to provide that housing. It'll be tricky to actually reach those population projections.
What is the goal, the ultimate goal of this plan that may be adopted? Is it to decide on one area where the city council will say that's where you're going to grow and we're not going to approve anything else in any other area? Is it a suggestion to developers? In other words, what is the goal of this plan ultimately?
So I think that's a little bit yet to be determined. So our last meeting with council 2 weeks ago was trying to get a better grasp on what are their goals for the plan. I think in general, it's land use is going to be very important because that's how we're going to put the 15,000 people into the city, into the community. The plan itself, though, is trying to also address character, understand what's important to invest in and reinvestment in existing part of the cities. So the plan has to be able to deal with more things that we want to coordinate as the city, not just the external growth. But when you talk about the external growth itself, it's going to be that balance. I think it's not likely to just be one place. I think that we've seen in the city, we tried to do that in 97. We tried to say we only want to grow one place, and then we quickly had to backpedal and say, well, this would be an okay option, this would be an okay option, and started to layer in different reasons why. So it kind of unraveled the concept of the plan because we weren't really following it because we were modifying it quite a bit.
That's really smart to have more of a flexible plan because I was on the YMCA board in Des Moines in the 70s, and at that time, we had people come in who were involved in planning, and they projected that growth to the west was going to slow down, and growth to the southeast of Des Moines was going to increase. They were wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, look at Waukee and all these areas. And, of course, we have had significant growth in Altoona, and that is happening. But I didn't hear them projecting that at the time.
Yeah.
And so your best guess sometimes, all you can do is go with what you have, and what you project is based on what you expect to happen, and it may or may not. So it's a complex thing to do.
It is. And in this case, though, because of what we've already analyzed, all of these areas will require a substantial city participation or some coordination with that developer. So if we didn't want something to happen, it would be very difficult for it to occur just in the market. So that we're going to have a pretty strong role in whichever way
we go. So a developer can't just come in and do what they want to do. They have to conform to what your expectations.
They would always have to conform, but the issue is that cost element. about what does it take to get that mile of sewer somewhere, or what does it cost to widen that arterial road. So a developer might be more than willing to build, but they might not be able to support that off-site infrastructure.
And that's the leverage the city would have with this plan.
Yes, and that's how it is today as well. But I think in this plan we'll have a little bit clearer structure about what are those sequences of things that need to be done and why we would want to do them in that order, or what we want to see in these areas to meet our goals, not just say it's growth.
What are the odds now? Obviously, developers up to now have wanted to grow north and west in Ames. What are the odds, and I know you're not an odds maker and you really don't want to talk about what the council might do, but is it likely that the city would actually decide not to grow north or west given the developers' needs and wants in those areas?
Well, I think what you'll definitely see is we already have in the north – essentially up to 190th Street, so you know where the country club is, where Quarry Estates just north of Ada Hayden is. That area, there's a lot of vacant land there. That area can continue to be developed. We've already put pipes in the ground. We've already set up support for that area. It's going to be the north growth is really the question beyond 190th Street. So even if we decide to go south and west, there'll still be growth north for at least a while. And that might be the most immediate place we see anything happen, because it's one of the few areas you can just keep going with what we've been doing.
Okay. And then you'd think that the east side would be continued manufacturing and industrial?
Well, I think the east side's probably the most interesting conversation in the whole plan. We have a 1,200-acre area, which is over 2 square miles of area set aside for industrial use. Rail access on one side. Lincoln Highway goes through the middle. For the south access, we're going to have a new interchange on Highway 30 that gives you direct access right into the heart of that industrial area. DOT is pursuing that project. So that's a lot of area. We don't know the type of user. If it's manufacturing, is it warehousing? What's the employment concentration? It's not going to be the research park. It's not going to be high-level office use probably. But that's at least 3,000 jobs. Could be 5,000 jobs in that area. So that's a 15% increase just in that one area. So when I look at the east, I say, hey, we have a lot of jobs here. We're still planning for a regional commercial piece at the 13th Street exit on I-35. That's a lot of access. That's a lot of things that are valuable to many people in other places. What does it look like to support a community out there? Does it have better job access? Does it have the ability to not have negative effects on the rest of the community because it's using other resources that existing members of the community aren't using very often? Does it have that regional context? And I think that's going to be the great conversation, is whether building there, having that regional access to I-35 is a valuable thing to the city, and is it a valuable thing to developers to unlock a market that does not exist today?
Let's talk briefly about another development, and that's the one that we heard about a year ago on Lincoln Way, north side of Lincoln Way, between Duff and Kellogg roughly. A group out of Chicago came in with some plans for multi-use development, retail on the ground floor, condos, shops, parking. Very ambitious plan. Haven't heard a lot about that. What's the status of that?
Well, again, at the last council meeting, there was a little bit of an update on it, not by staff, but my property owner. Uh-huh. So the developer was looking at the ability to go where the former Taco Timing KFC location at the intersection of Clark and Lincoln Way to move the Starbucks that's in the middle of the block there. And they view that as unlocking the potential for that whole block. And in this year and a half, 2 years that we've been working with Argent, how do you deal with a property that may or may not stay there? What are the options to work around it versus move it? So at that last meeting, Chuck Winkleblack from Hunziker Companies, who's essentially the property owner, he's not Argent, but he's helping to assemble the properties, showed us some examples of different modifications there. Where I think it's very likely whoever the group is, it may not be Argent, will have some large element of a hotel component, not your normal run-of-the-mill interstate-oriented kind of hotel, but some kind of nicer facility. Definitely will have a housing element. And then how are we mixing in office use or commercial use with some public space?
The area is between Duff and Clark.
Yeah,
I meant to say Duff and Clark.
Yeah, so there's a lot of areas it could go. The main emphasis right now is between Kellogg and Clark.
Right. So what's the goal there, though? Because is it to completely level what's there now and redevelop the whole area?
That's where it's headed. So the corridor plan said, man, we have a lot of cut-up areas with these little sites, little parking lots, one-story buildings, very – strip commercial oriented, worked for a long time, but into the future, is that really the efficient use of land in the center of the city? So the plan saying, hey, more intense is better. This is the best place for infill in the city.
Wow.
You've got access. You have utility capacity. You have a market for it, too. And it's going to support downtown if you bring people next to it.
Yeah.
So the city's really in and invested in this plan to say we want to see this happen with larger buildings. And it'll be different frames. So we don't have a lot of large buildings. And it's not campus town. That's the other thing I always have to talk about. It's not a campus town version of approach here where we're just doing student housing and that's all that matters. This is more about creating a development that has a lot of things in it and would work for citizens of the city to come visit and want to be there, not just for a kind of a student environment.
And it wouldn't harm Main Street.
No, I don't. We don't believe that at all. We think it'll augment the market for Main Street.
Wow,
that sounds intelligent and wise. What sort of things will happen as you look south in Ames? What do you think will happen in the south?
How far south?
Well,
how far do you want to go?
Ankeny? No, I'm just thinking about the area around the airport and down Highway 69. What sort of things do you think will develop there?
Well, we have the airport does have a master plan. They're gonna look at extending that north south runway, which would again extend their reach, have more impact of keeping things ag further south of the airport. So we always know that area is a protected area for runway protection.
Sure.
Research Park is going to have some more expansion over time. We know that as well. And then there's a developer might have an interesting project. It's a local landowner that's looking at developing about 40 acres of land off of the Cedar Lane area. So it's a little bit west of the Research Park. And he's trying to think about kind of a novel concept of looking at more clustered housing that we haven't seen for a long time in Ames, focused around open space and trails in a little bit different manner. And he's just gotten annexed to the city. So we'll see if there might be a pretty interesting project coming down that way.
Wow.
Kelly, we're out of time. Thank you so much for whirling in here. We want to have you back.
Okay.
Because this 2040 plan, I suspect, is going to be on the agenda for a lot of councils.
Yeah, that's the number one item for the next 6 months.
We'll have you back. Kelly Diekman, Planning and Housing Director for the City of Ames. Now, don't touch that dial, because after this brief time out, we're going to look at the week's news from the Ames Tribune. And after that, Susan Gwiazda, the public relations guru for the City of Ames. The guru joins us along with her special guest, Fire Chief Rich Higgins.
With more of Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio, I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart, 24 minutes after the hour on this Friday. Time for our weekly rundown of news from the pages of the Ames Trib, and there was plenty to report last week, starting with Saturday when the Trib had word that the Iowa State University Police Department had started investigating after multiple potential victims had come forward about alleged misconduct after that Iowa State University football game, Iowa football game at Jack Trice Stadium a few weekends ago. Band members from the U of I had alleged that they were harassed and, in at least one case, injured as they left the game. Also Saturday, report that the Ames City Council had approved rezoning land at the corner of Lincoln Way and Clark Avenue so the new Starbucks coffee shop could be built there. Starbucks now has a building just east of that rezoned land but wants to move to the new site and construct a building with a more modern drive-through. Sunday's paper brought word that the person Story County supervisors had chosen to fill the vacant Director of External Operations position had declined the offer. No reason given why Eric Christensen, who is now a county administrator in Minnesota, said no. Now Story County supervisors have offered the job to Sandra King, who is a faculty member at Minnesota State University in Mankato. Also Sunday, word that the Ames School District will increase its spending on special education with the money going to help the district's staffing requirements for special ed. And, of course, there were several stories on the sports pages about Iowa State University's 23-21 loss to Baylor last Saturday in a Big 12 conference game. Tuesday's paper reported on something that had happened last Friday, that 33,000 Story County residents had received either a call, text, or email from the county's emergency management agency. It was the first ever testing of the countywide system. And the paper had word about the visit of Democratic presidential hopeful Tulsi Gabbard to Nevada. Among other things, she talked about health care and foreign affairs. Wednesday's paper brought word that Barb Neal had been appointed as CyRide's new director. Neal has been with CyRide since 1991, and she was a finalist in the nationwide search for a new director. Her duties will include planning and coordination of all money, maintenance, and personnel activities for CyRide. Also word that an Ames company had announced a merger which will create a combined company focusing on developing therapies to treat rare diseases. New Link Genetics Corporation, which is based at the Iowa State University Research Park, will combine with Lumos Pharma, which is a private biopharmaceutical company. The move will result in the reduction of 28 jobs. Also Wednesday, a report that 8 months after the merger of Drive Ames and World of Wheels, the doors to its sales floor on South 16th Street in Ames were closed on Tuesday. In addition, all vehicles had been moved, and the office inside the building was empty. Also a feature story about Ames Haunted Forest, which is opening for its 20th consecutive year tonight at 7. It's going to run through November 1st. The Haunted Forest is on South 4th Street, just east of the Iowa State campus. Yesterday's paper reported that fire had destroyed a mobile home on Lincoln Way, just west of the city limits. Blaze broke out in a trailer in the Maple Grove Mobile Home Park. No one was injured. From fire to rain, the Tribune reported that Wednesday's rain had forced the cancellation of the mayor's downtown Healthy Estate Walk in Ames for the first time in the walk's history. There will be no makeup date for that event. Also yesterday, word that candidates for the Ames City Council in next month's election tackled questions from residents during a candidate forum at City Hall on Tuesday night. The questions ranged from community safety to affordable housing to climate change. The election, of course, is November 5th. Today's paper, Friday's, has word that Democratic presidential hopeful Kamala Harris is going to make two campaign stops in Ames over the next few days. The California senator is going to make a town hall-type appearance at the Sheman Building at the Iowa State Center on Sunday at 6:20 p.m. Then she's going to appear at Cafe Diem on Main Street here in Ames at 5 o'clock on Monday to meet with Ames People Demanding Action, Moms Demanding Action, a group working for stopping gun violence in the United States. And one more note today in the paper, word that teen mental health first aid training is going to become part of the Ames High School curriculum for 10th grade children in health classes. District staff members will go to Las Vegas later this month for training. Ames High is one of 70 schools chosen to take part in the project by Johns Hopkins University. And that is your brief summary of the week's news from the Ames Tribune. Don't go away. Coming up next, Susan Guiazda from the City of Ames joins us along with her guest, Fire Chief Rich Higgins. And after that, guess what? Maggie Westfold's going to join us, bring us another one of her unique looks at life right here in Iowa. Welcome back to more of Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio. It is half past the hour. My name's Dennis Hart.
And I'm Paul Wearson. Joining us now is one of our favorite people, Susan Gwiazda, the public relations manager for the City of Ames, and she's brought along a guest who just happens to be City Fire Chief Rich Higgins. Welcome to Susan and Rich.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Well, Susan, how are you?
I'm doing very well. It's a very brisk fall morning.
It is brisk fall. Yes, it is.
Well, tell us about your special guest, Fire Chief Rich Higgins.
Well, I'm excited to bring Fire Chief Rich Higgins with me today because October is a very important month in the world of fire safety.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. We got Fire Prevention Week coming up starting this Sunday, and we'll be having an open house on Saturday, October 12th from 9 to noon over at Fire Station Number 1. We're excited to get the community into the fire station over there at 13th and Burnett and show off some of the great tools that we have that we work with, but then also to help spread a fire safety message. And it's truly a great day. We bring about 1,000 people, and it's a great morning.
About kids and fire prevention.
Yeah.
You know, kids love fire trucks. And I was coaching a flag football team of third and fourth grade boys, you know, right across from the West Des Moines Fire Station. And if the fire trucks moved or anything happened over there with trucks, I lost them. They just turned and stared. And I know you have a lot of fire prevention and increased knowledge of the whole idea of fire prevention and schools. You reach out to schools, don't you, Rick?
Yeah, absolutely. Next week we'll be hitting all the Ames schools. We'll be from third grade and below down to preschoolers. We have a great fire safety message. We get out there and visit with the kids. And, of course, we do bring a fire truck, and that is a draw.
Oh, yes, yes.
Even when I hear sirens go by the fire station, I'm looking out the window if it's not one of ours to see what's going on. So,
Rich, this is an important time of the year because as it gets colder, there's some more danger in people's homes that they may not be aware of because they're about to turn on their heat and they're about to try to warm themselves up. Talk about some of the dangers that could be out there as we get colder.
Yeah, I know I had to click my furnace on for the kids this morning.
Well,
it was cold.
Did,
they had the blankets
yeah.
out. And so one of the things we want people to do is when it comes to turn on your furnace for the first time is go ahead and go have a routine maintenance inspection of your furnace. It's always a good idea to have that done every year. We also want to make sure people know about carbon monoxide. So carbon monoxide is odorless, poisonless, tasteless, colorless gas that when you start running fuel-fired appliances, it's an off product. Can be there. And so if you don't have a detector to find out if you have carbon monoxide, it could be slowly poisoning you, or it could be something that's pretty quick if you have a bad heat exchanger, you're not exhausting those fumes to the outside, that could quickly overcome you and your family and make you really sick. And we've had some cases in Ames where we've had people get sick. And I'm thinking back to one call that we had is probably about 10 years ago where we had crews went out for an elderly woman that wasn't feeling very well. We arrived on scene, and luckily we had a CO monitor on our bay, carbon monoxide detector, and it started going into alert. Well, sure enough, this gal had carbon monoxide poisoning. And if it wasn't for having that device on our bag, we wouldn't have known. We just would have treated it as somebody with flu-like symptoms.
Are carbon monoxide detectors mandatory in homes?
They are not. They are for rental units, but they're not for single-family dwelling homes. We do encourage that. All new homes, when they go through and get their inspection, they are required to have dual sensor. And one of the options for And when I say dual sensors, I'm talking about smoke detection. One of the options for a dual sensor smoke detector is to have the smoke side, so a photoionization detection, but then also the carbon monoxide detection. So that's what we've really been pushing people to do is get the photoelectric and the carbon monoxide detector for their dual sensor smoke detector in their homes.
Well, you know, that's really making a lot of sense because I live on a farm and I have a carbon monoxide detector. And I wouldn't feel right if I didn't have that because I have an old furnace and all kinds of things can go wrong. The other thing I think about in fire safety in the wintertime is space heaters. That's a problem, isn't it, Rich?
It is. You know, the UL has done Underwriters Laboratory. They've done a great job of making sure that the products that come out on the market for space heaters are safe. But that doesn't mean us as consumers always follow all the directions. I don't know about you guys, but sometimes when I open up a box, it's not my go-to to get out the instruction manual and read through it word by word.
Men don't read instructions.
Yeah. No, we need it, but we don't read them.
Right.
Susan can attest to that.
and so the biggest problem we run to is people just putting space heaters too close to curtains, to beds, to couches, and that's the problem that we run into. So, you just got to make sure that you're reading the instruction manual. Usually there's at least 3 foot. You want to keep a distance between anything that's combustible and your space heater.
Talk about the need also to do such simple things as changing the battery in your smoke detectors, because a lot of folks don't do that, and changing the filter in your heater. Those are all very important things.
Absolutely. So smoke detectors, we want you checking those at least twice a year. And during daylight savings time when we switch over, those are always great reminders to go ahead and, number one, check your batteries. But then, number two, actually push that little button that says test on there. Make sure it works. I know at my house I take down every detector. I unhook it. I change out the battery. Even if it doesn't need to be changed, I save those for the kids' toys. But I go ahead and replace the battery, blow it out, and then put it back up there and hit that test button and make sure all the other alarms in the house go off. And I do that twice a year. Yep. And so we want to encourage all of our residents to do that. It's pretty easy to do. And if for some reason you're not able to get up to a detector in your home, it's maybe up a little high, out of reach, you don't feel comfortable getting on a ladder, give us a call up at Fire Station Number 1. We'll gladly come out. We'll test those for you.
That's good to know that.
Yeah, we'll help
change batteries. I'm talking about someone who's elderly and alone in their home. It may not occur to them to call the fire department about that.
Absolutely, and that's something we want to do. That the best time that we can come out and visit you is before you ever have a fire. That's we don't want to see you on that worst day. We want to get out there and help you be fire safe year round, and that's one simple thing that we can do. There's also a lifespan that smoke detectors have that a lot of people kind of forget. You move into your home, it's up there. Maybe you change the battery or check it once, twice a year, hopefully. But you don't ever think about replacing the whole detector. So what we recommend is they have born-on dates, believe it or not. All the detectors do. And they also have an end-of-life date on there. All the new detectors, they'll go into alarm when they've reached the end of life. But we're telling people when you get to that 7-year point, it's time to start changing out your detectors. Mm-hmm. If you have to buy a couple a year, however you need to do it, it's just time to start replacing
them. So everyone should check that. There's a born and an expiration date.
Yep.
Somewhere on that label.
Absolutely.
And you need to be informed about that.
Yep.
So that's something I didn't know until this moment. That's why we have people like Rich on.
People who actually know something.
Yes.
Yeah. As opposed to us. What about the filter situation? I think that's important, too, to talk about.
Yeah. So depending on your manufacturer's recommendation, I know at our furnace we change ours out with the season. So when we come into fall, we change it out. And when we get into spring, we also change it out. But when you don't have a clean filter, it can slow down the air moving through. And it can build up more dust, which can create further problems down the line, especially if you have a furnace malfunction. Filter can actually be a potential fire hazard in there.
Now, we hear about this every year, and yet it seems silly, and yet it happens across the country and probably here in Ames. Christmas tree fires. I know we're a few months away, but talk about that. I mean, everybody says, oh, no, my Christmas tree's never catching fire, and yet they do.
They do, and when they go fast. We love live Christmas trees. There's something about
the
smell, the beauty of them. In fact, when I was younger, I actually worked on a Christmas tree farm with my uncle, and great memories there. But if you don't take good care of them, it becomes basically just a tree in your house that's drying out, ready to combust. And it doesn't take much when you start stringing Christmas lights on there. And I'm sure people aren't changing their Christmas lights out every year. I'm sure it's the same strand that they've had for many years. And sometimes those develop shorts. And so we just want to make sure if you have a live Christmas tree that you're watering it. We have little cards that we've teamed up with the vendors, local vendors, Christmas tree vendors, to get these tags on there. They're smart tags that remind you how to take care of your Christmas tree. So just some quick, easy tips with watering it daily, trying to keep track of when the needles start to dry out, that's time to take it out of there and time to take off your decorations from the tree. Mm-hmm. So a lot of good safety tips that hopefully when you get that live Christmas tree in Ames, it'll already have that tag on there.
Yeah, one good thing about the modern Christmas lights, they don't produce the heat. You know, I grew up in the 50s, and those big bulbs, they produced a lot
of heat. Oh, they were hot. Yeah. I remember that.
And they would dry the tree out. And
and you'd have bubblers. Remember the bubblers?
Oh, the bubbling lights.
And they were hot. They were lovely. I loved those bubblers, but boy, they were hot.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, we had candles in the early part of the century. And, of course, those were just waiting to burn up Christmas trees.
Yeah.
Live candles.
It's crazy to think some of the things we've done.
Candles are a hazard, too, aren't they? People who walk out and neglect the candle that's burning.
Absolutely. We understand people are going to have candles, and we're not anti-candle by any means. We just want you to be responsible. Don't leave the candle unattended into a room. We've had pets that have come along and start to push the candle off, or we have kids that are curious. So if you have a candle lit, you stay in the room with it. If you're leaving the room, blow it out, and when you come back, you can light it. And with so many of the Scentis that they have out there, you don't even need to have a live flame anymore. There's so many different different products that are out there that will help produce smells that you're looking for. That
now, of course, this rotten egg smell that they inject into propane and gas. When people smell gas, what should they do? Is they call you or do they call the vendor?
Yes. So if you smell gas in your home, call 911 and get out of the house. Mm-hmm. What's the most important thing you can do? What you're smelling is mercaptan. They actually add that to the natural gas to – it's an odorant that makes you aware that you have a natural gas leak or an LP leak. So get out of the house. Call 911. We'll come out. We'll investigate. Sometimes we just come and we shut off the gas right away, and then we notify your gas provider, where it's Alliant, Midland. They'll come out and try to figure out where the leak's coming from.
Rich, it's important to do that. You don't make the phone call in the house.
You
leave the house because your phone can spark, I understand, gas.
It very well could, and we just want you to get out. Because sometimes if you're in your house and you call, you don't think about getting out. You all of a sudden become an investigator and want to figure out where that smell's coming from.
And don't try to turn off the gas yourself.
Right. Yeah, don't go outside and turn off the gas on the home. Let us do that.
Yeah.
If you go over and you find that you left a burner on and the flame went out on your stove or something like that, then obviously turn the lever and call us. Well, at the very least, we'll come out, make sure there's no other leaks, and we'll ventilate the house to get that smell out of there for you.
Gentlemen, Susan has been sitting here very quietly, and she has a ton of things to say in a few minutes to say. Welcome, Susan.
It's great. It's fabulous to listen to Rich's helpful tips. And we're in the season where, fire safety is extremely important. And the open house every year is such a great reminder. It really is wonderful outreach to kids. We get into the schools. And kids react really positively to that fire safety message, and they take it back to the homes. Mm-hmm. So we love that opportunity, and we look for more opportunities to get out and educate AIM citizens about fire safety.
What else is going on in the city?
Well, speaking of kids, one of the bigger questions we'll get this time of year is trick-or-treating. Again, trick-or-treating is on Halloween. It is Thursday, October 31st, and we recommend kids trick-or-treat from 5:30 to 7:30. It's pretty dark.
Yes.
By the end of October, and between 5:30 and 7:30, it's getting kids off the streets before it's super late and getting them ready for school the next morning. And that's just the recommended hours. So people, mark your calendars. The other thing to remember is regarding Halloween and pumpkins and jack-o'-lanterns is that, once again, Resource Recovery will take those old pumpkins at the end of October in a composting project. We've done it for a couple years now, where we don't want you to throw those vegetables in the garbage. Mm-hmm. They're mushy, and they can contaminate other garbage. I know that you all know that we have a waste-to-energy facility here where we produce fuel from the trash. And when we get a lot of mushy pumpkins in there, it's not as beneficial as the other product that we're producing. So save those pumpkins, the jack-o'-lanterns, the carved ones, the ones that you're using for decoration, the squash, the gourds, all that stuff can be taken to Resource Recovery at the end of October, and there'll be bins outside the facility at 110 Center Avenue. Have you been there?
Yes.
Yes,
we have.
Yeah. So great place. Stop by, drop your stuff off, and
they actually tried to compost Paul and me, and we said, no, we don't want
volunteering.
So the other thing that we get a ton of questions about is when are the yard waste days that are no charge to Story County residents. This is a big deal. People have a lot of leaves and yard waste to get rid of, and we have set those dates. They are on our website at cityofames.org, but they're also Saturdays in November. And it's not we try to have them be on non-home football games, but we didn't hit them all this year. But we've got in November for your yard waste days at no charge. It is November 2nd, November 9th, November 16th, and November 30th. November 30th is interesting because that's the Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious how many people will be out there doing their yards.
Now, how do people have to prepare this for pickup? What do they have to do?
We see all different ways. Again, you're taking them out to the yard waste site. We see people do it all different ways.
They take it out.
We see people put them in compostable bags, like the brown paper bags you can pick up at the hardware stores. And then you can just toss them and go. So if you bring your yard waste in the brown paper bags, you can just throw them into the pile and go. You can use big, hefty plastic bags, but then you have to dump them. Uh-huh. And some people want those big, hefty bags back. Some of them are really actually pretty strong, and you could reuse them. So, and then the other way I've seen, which I find very interesting, is people will lay tarp down in the bottom in the back of a pickup, and they'll just throw the leaves right into the back of the pickup, and then they pull the tarp and dump it into the pile.
What a great idea.
Yeah. I don't have a pickup, so make friends with somebody who has a pickup truck.
How many people actually do this and take their stuff out there
hundreds,
during these?
Hundreds. You know, Rich, have you done it?
No, I have not, actually.
Okay. Well, I've done it several times, and I've loaded my van up with bags and bags of leaves and gotten out there. You know, people ask, when's the best time to go? Yeah. A lot of people line up to go. It's the hour's the same every time. It is 8 to 4. And so a lot of people come right at 8. It's my understanding that's not the best time to come. So I usually go around the lunch hour, but I think it just depends on how your luck is that day. Mm-hmm. The other important thing this year, November 9th is the day that you can turn in leaves and brush. So you have a lot of twigs or you've trimmed some trees. You want to bring that brush in. That is a big day. And we get a lot of concerns every year that it's one day for leaves and brush and mm-hmm. all the other days are leaves only. And, well, I can't make that one Saturday. It just doesn't work in my schedule. So this year we're offering a voucher. If you cannot make the November 9th Leaves and Brush Day, you can go to Resource Recovery and pick up a voucher, and you can use that voucher on November 8th, November 11th, or November 13th, which is a Friday, Monday, or Wednesday. And so that gives people a little bit more flexibility. I know it's not perfect. It's not. You can't use it any day. But you can pick up the voucher, and then you can go on one of those other days. And we also hope that this kind of helps with eliminating the free brush day is the big day. And mm-hmm. so we get a lot of traffic that day. So we're hoping that this might reduce that traffic a little bit more and help people sort of plan their fall. Just looking ahead, just remember it always throws people off, is that the city is closed in November for Veterans Day on Monday, November 11th. So there are no charges to the meters that day, and it does kind of throw people. Now, Columbus Day in October, we are working, but Veterans Day in November, we are not working. So another good thing to remember. Just in general, if you have questions about the City of Ames, our website is a huge source of information, cityofames.org. We are also on several social media channels, platforms. Find the City of Ames on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. You can find Ames Fire on those channels as well. Mm-hmm. You can find Ames Police. You can find Ames Parks and Recreation. We are trying to be multi-platform because we want to be where our residents are getting their information.
Very briefly, with Halloween coming up, you mentioned it already. Does the city do anything special that night in terms of police patrols or anything like that to keep kids safe while they're walking around?
Well, we do some advance information. We always send out safety tips on how kids can better make themselves visible. But sure, we're always out there looking after everyone.
Yeah, and we make sure the lights are on at the fire station, and we have our firefighters usually out in the area, so that way if kids feel threatened or need a safe place to come to, they always have the fire station to stop by.
We have to go. We're out of time. We want to thank both of you for being here. Rich Higgins, Fire Chief, Susan Guiazda, Guru of Public Relations for the city. Pleasure having you both here. And I'm going to take off for California after next week's show, so Susan, we'll see each other next spring.
I'll still be here.
I hope I will be, too. Thanks very much. Now, don't go away. There's still more to come. After this brief pause, old friend Maggie Westfold, we think she's going to join us with another of her unique takes on life right here in Iowa. Thank you.
we're back with Local Talk Friday, and we're happy to have our friend and colleague Maggie Westfold joining us with another of her takes about life in Iowa. Hello, Maggie.
Hi, Paul. Thank you, Paul and Dennis.
Hey, Maggie.
It's nice to be back. Today, I thought I'd talk a little about the obsession we seem to have these days with photography. With the evolution of mobile phones from those handy little flip phones to the now very common smartphone, snapping a picture is literally as simple as picking up your phone, aiming, and firing, so to speak. And instantly, you can assess your results and store them in your photo gallery or delete altogether. Of course, sharing is an option. We can send a picture via email, text, private messaging on Facebook, or post it for all the world to see on your own Facebook page. I don't do Twitter or Snapchat, but those are choices too. And there's no end to the way a photo can fly around the world in a heartbeat, and that is scary. One of the things I love about photos taken on my smartphone is that editing options eliminate the need to worry much about how you frame the picture to start with. Many things can be tweaked or refined quite easily if needed. You can even use a filter to make your photo look like a work of art. And I guarantee you it's all quite easy, folks, because even I can manage some of that. My husband and I grew up in the era when few photos were taken. We do each have baby pictures and childhood family photos of ourselves, but there are few. It just was not a priority post-World War II to own an expensive camera and take pictures regularly. Many old family photos are focused on events such as birthdays or weddings or funerals, and most were taken with something like a Kodak Brownie point-and-shoot with a flash cube. The photos are amazingly clear given the equipment's lack of sophistication from that time. Black and white was more common than color, and often when color portraits were purchased from professional photographers, the colorizing, as it was called, was done with oil pencil by an artist and sprayed with a fixative. My high school senior portrait was colorized, and I still smile at the perfect peachy complexion that young woman has, thanks to the colorizing artist. Today, my grandkids have no memory of anything other than instant gratification where photos are concerned, and video clips of themselves doing silly little dances or songs for Grandma and Grandpa are pretty common. Gone are the days of purchasing a roll of film, loading the camera, taking the pictures, and then taking exposed film to the drugstore for processing. We waited several days or a week even to see a photo and know if we had a good one for the photo album. Today, everyone's a photographer, and the selfies fill the pages of Facebook day after day. A person can use a selfie stick to extend the camera for a wider angle. The possibilities are endless, and the selfie obsession got me to thinking one day. A few years back, after my mother passed away, I thought perhaps I should start taking selfies so my family would have an approved one at hand the day they need a portrait to place beside the urn holding my cremated remains. You think that's morbid thinking? I don't really. A woman has only so many ways to control what may go on once they're gone from this earth, and I even have a poem that outlines just how I went about taking that selfie, and the last line of that poem says something akin to using just the right lighting and just the right angle so as not to make me look dead.
Well, actually, I was a photographer. That's one of my hobbies.
Oh.
I did senior pictures. I did weddings. I had a dark room in my bathroom.
My
and, you know, you
goodness.
Had the three baths. You had developer, fixative, and stop bath. And, you know, it was magical to watch that image come up. And, you know, it was just I had a single lens reflex Pentax where you look through the lens, you know. Mm-hmm. But before you had the rangefinder camera, and you couldn't see through the lens. And so people would send a roll of film in to get developed, not knowing they had the lens cap on. A blank.
Maggie, always, you have delighted us, and you're not with us next week. It's my last broadcast next week before we go back to California.
Right.
So I'm going to put you on the spot. Would you come back next spring when I'm back?
Well, we can plan on that, and we'll hope that can happen. So let's just say it's a plan, okay?
Let's say it's a plan. You are a delight. Thanks for joining us this past summer. We have loved it.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Local Talk Friday. I'm still Dennis Hart.
And Local Talk airs today at noon and 5 p.m. here on KHOI, right at 89.1 FM. And you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org, as well as finding links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris. You can hear it in the background. From their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. I bet everybody knows who Kate Shelley is, but if you don't, you can find out pretty easily. She's a local heroine. Local Talk's a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come on down and join the Local Talk team.
And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio. Have a great weekend.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting The Kingdom Choir, Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information can be found at center.iastate.edu.